This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Self-driving cars were the stuff of science fiction, but like so much of science fiction, they have become a reality. Even though they are in their infancy, some car manufacturers insist you'll be able to buy one soon, and long-haul truck drivers should certainly be looking in their rear-view mirrors because self-driving big rigs are also being promised. Of course, one of the real challenges is to make sure these cars and trucks can operate safely in a real world in which they share the road with people. Another challenge is making us feel comfortable with their presence on the roads that we'll ultimately be sharing with them. A lot of testing is being done, and North Carolina is one of the test tracks. Raleigh's Triangle Expressway toll road will soon have experimental driverless cars mixing in. How much is left to do before these cars begin to make inroads on our roads? What are some of the speed bumps on the road to success? Will this be a case where the law will have to catch up to the technology? We explore the dawn of this new automotive age with Dr. Missy Cummings, director of the Humans and Autonomy Laboratory at Duke University, who joins us from studios at WUNC in Durham. Good morning.
Good morning.
And with us by phone is Cecilia Kang, technology and policy reporter for The New York Times. Thank you for being with us as well.
Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. You may have some questions of your own about this. You can email us at charlottetalks at WFAE.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Let me begin with you, Doctor, because you, among your research interests, is human-unmanned vehicle interaction. And I'm curious why you would be interested in that, given the fact that you're a former naval officer and military pilot, one of the Navy's first female fighter pilots. Obviously, you like operating machinery, and yet you're working to take control of cars out of the hands of us mere mortals. Why?
Well, I know. I think it sounds a little bit like I'm Benedict Arnold to my kind, but the reality is that I saw many people die. You know, at one point during my flying career with the Navy, we were losing one pilot a month in accidents. That's a lot of people. And almost every accident was due to pilot error. And these are people who are highly trained. Driving is a much worse situation. So most accidents are caused by human inattentiveness. And it's only getting worse. We just saw a recent uptick in the annual death rate in cars. And it's funny, you know. I mean, it's true. While I was young, I liked to light my hair on fire and fly very fast. But now I'm a mom of a 9-year-old. And frankly, I want to get driverless cars in place before she turns 16.
Wow. Okay. Cecilia, prior to working for the New York Times and the Washington Post, you covered high tech for the San Jose Mercury News. Is this where the push for driverless car technology is coming from? Is it coming from Silicon Valley, or is it coming from Detroit? Is it coming from the government? What's the genesis of the push?
Definitely a lot of it is coming from Silicon Valley. It's really interesting to see how technology companies are turning their attention toward transportation. You know, a lot of the early 2000s was dominated by social media companies and innovations in that field. And now a lot of companies are turning toward big, heavy machinery, big urban problem ideas, transportation. They're looking at putting rockets on the moon. There's a lot of interesting, big sort of clashes that are occurring between technologists as well as sort of incumbent, simple transportation industries. And so a lot of it is coming from Silicon Valley, but Detroit has certainly caught on. Ford is well along on their way, testing as well as producing the hardware and software for driverless cars. They have a big center in Palo Alto in the middle of Silicon Valley, research center there. And Nissan and GM and Volvo are, a lot of the other car makers are also on board. Everyone agrees that in the future, there will be a bigger role for driverless cars. When that happens and how that occurs is sort of the big question.
Is this because all these people who dedicated their lives to computers and making computers what they are today, we've pretty much hit the, at least for the consumer, we've hit the plateau. I can't fathom that we would need a computer much faster or much robust, much more robust than what most of us have in our pockets on our smartphones or on our desks on our desktop computers. And this is the natural extension of that next thing, to use this supercomputing power and the code that these people can now write to essentially drive cars and fly rocket ships. Is that just the natural extension of things?
I think it's a natural extension, and also with all technology, the natural evolution is for software and hardware to get cheaper over time. Mm-hmm. And so cameras, radars, all these different technologies that were prohibitively expensive a decade ago can be strapped onto cars, and they're just much better and cheaper. And so it makes sense to apply technology that already exists and can be improved upon on cars.
Because we have in our pockets more computing power than they had on the first Apollo mission that landed on the moon. It's pretty amazing. Doctor, we talked about Silicon Valley being the genesis of this and about Detroit being interested in this, but you say that autonomous driving would not have happened had it not been for universities and the research that they've been conducting. Have these institutions been doing this on their own because they're being paid to do it by the automobile or the computer companies?
Well, to be fair, the true genesis of the driverless car movement came from DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency in D.C., you know, the military's technology innovator. And so they were the ones that started sponsoring the Grand Challenges. And so they originally put the carrot on the stick that made the universities then get into this research. And so it wasn't something that really spawned from the university without incentivization through money from DARPA. So, you know, I mean, but that's a very typical way that research happens in the real world. And so then once that became so successful, the research and DARPA's involvement, this is a classic example of a technology that started in the military and that has spun out of the military. And I think one of the most interesting places that we are in history is now that it has spun so quickly out of the military, that your average consumer in the very near term will have much more automated advanced capability in their car than a soldier will in the military.
Well, we're already seeing cars that will stop themselves if they sense a collision coming. We've already seen that. We have self-parking cars now in some cases. And as we said at the very top of the show, there's going to be a test track essentially on a public highway in North Carolina. And this has been happening around the country too. Where does this technology stand right now? Are there cars that are currently in production, test vehicles, that can navigate a city street or an interstate highway safely without a driver?
Yes,
well,
there are.
I say no.
Well,
I say no.
Okay, well, let's hear the yes, and then we'll
first.
Hear the no. Well, go ahead first. Go ahead, doctor. Tell us why no. Why is the answer no?
So it really means you have to be very clear about your definition. Are there vehicles that can do some elements of navigation in production right now? So if you qualify it and you give it a lot of qualifiers, then you could say Tesla is that car, the Tesla with the autopilot. But is there a car in production that can navigate point to point completely driverless without a human attendant to it? That answer is no, and it's going to be no for a long time.
And Cecilia Kang, you say
I agree.
Yes.
I do agree with that.
Okay.
I agree that in production, there is currently not a car. There is testing of vehicles around Mountain View with Waymo, Google's self-driverless effort, in Pittsburgh and parts of Arizona by Uber, where you do have cars that are in many ways almost fully automated, but there has to be a human behind the wheel. Mm-hmm. And all of these cars have a wheel and a pedal and pedals, because none of these testing grounds allow for completely what you would, you know, sort of this futuristic vision of a box that moves without a wheel and a, you know, a seat and pedals to accelerate and brake. That does not exist at this moment. That's partly regulatory, and that's also partly because they're not at the point yet that one can feel that these cars can coexist with other cars. So, no, there is currently not one in production. You, as a consumer, cannot expect within the next couple years to buy a fully autonomous car for many reasons, regulatory and because the technology is not there yet.
And the question is,
Well, I just want to say, though, you as a consumer will not be able to buy that for at least 10 to 15 years. It's not a couple of years. It's much, much further into the future. There are serious technical problems that we need to overcome to truly get to autonomous car. Now, I'm a big fan of autonomy, and I want that to, you know, I want us to be working on it. But I do think that there's a lot of hype out there, and people do not understand that for a truly autonomous car to happen, we are at least a decade, if not more, away from that.
Okay. We're going to come back in a moment and talk more about why that will take so long, because some car companies have led us to believe that in the next 5 years, and in Audi's case, next year, there will be some kind of technology that would allow that. And there are a lot of questions to ask about data and about our being comfortable with other cars on the road that don't have drivers. We'll come back and talk about that in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking today about self-driving or driverless cars and where they stand today and where they will be tomorrow and when you can not drive one, but be an occupant of one. We're talking about this with Dr. Mary Cummings, Missy Cummings, who's Director of Humans and Autonomy Laboratory at Duke University. She's working on this up there. And Cecilia Kang, who's a technology and policy reporter for the New York Times. Cecilia has to leave us at 9:30, so I want to spend some time with you, Cecilia, in this next segment, just talking about safety and regulations and other things that you cover in the course of your job at the Times. When these cars become ready for use on the roadway in common usage, you've written that the federal government is betting that our highways will be safer because there'll be more self-driving vehicles on the road. Why?
The belief is that the tens of thousands of deaths related to car accidents that occur every year could go down with autonomous vehicles, that human error is behind, in the vast majority of these cases, behind these deaths. So the idea is that, and there's more concern about this because of the increase in distracted driving. A lot of this related to smartphone use, actually, and other technology use within the car by drivers. So the Department of Transportation, the previous administration, and I suspect the current administration as well, views distracted driving and human-related car deaths, human-caused car deaths, as a real health problem, a real problem for the country. One of the solutions that they see in the future is driverless cars, because the idea is that a car might make the right decisions, that more better decisions than a human will, that it can detect around them because the cameras and radars don't lie and they're fully on engaged all the time. Traffic. They can predict congestion. They can predict potential crashes about to happen. That's the idea behind what Anthony Fox, the former transportation secretary, said was why they were supporting guidelines and supporting generally guidelines for driverless cars and generally the advancement of autonomous vehicles.
And you said that the federal government, has already issued a checklist, and they were urging automakers and tech companies to use this checklist to prove the safety of their cars. What kind of things are on this checklist?
Well, there are several things. There's a 15-point safety standard checklist. And mind you, again, these are guidelines. This is not a federal law, but these are guidelines that were issued by NHTSA, the Department of Transportation, last September. There's a 15-point safety checklist that includes questions about how a car should react when its driverless technology fails, how it shares data with how data is collected, and other parts of this guideline. These guidelines include the call for states to adopt uniform regulations, because at this point, their states are moving in different speeds on how they approach driverless cars. Most state laws do not explicitly approve or ban driverless cars, and the testing of. So there was a push by NHTSA to have uniform state regulations. These are among some of the questions and the guidelines proposed offered by NHTSA, including cybersecurity, making sure the cars are secure, that there's some privacy efforts in place to make sure that data collected by these cars, that there's some sort of privacy policy so that consumers can feel that their data is secure in some way.
Won't this have to be nationally rolled out, these rules and regulations? For instance, some states you can turn right on red, other states you cannot. You're going to buy a car from a manufacturer. Are they going to program it state by state according to the law? Is it going to know, oh, I've just crossed a state line, and so now I can't turn right on red? Is it going to know that?
Well, you know, that's one of the tough sort of questions that are being sorted out right now. There are different driving cultures in different cities. You know, there's something known as the Pittsburgh Left. I don't quite understand that entirely, but there are all kinds of different ways that people that driving sort of styles that are acknowledged by locality that may not be picked up, say, if you drive from one state into another state. The cars themselves, that's something that the technologists are trying to figure out on a regulatory basis. I think that the regulators are thinking a little bit more higher level as to what kind of testing they'll allow, what kind of safety checkpoints that they'll require, how they want the car makers to deal with things like privacy and liability. And it's a really important question as to how these laws can differ state to state. On the federal level, I think the previous administration really wanted to give the states more autonomy on some of these decisions, but offer an umbrella sort of guideline as to how the federal Department of Transportation thinks that states should generally approach driverless cars. So a lot of these details are very important and hard, and they've yet to be sorted out.
Before I have to let you go in about a minute and a half, I just want to get in, just scratch the surface on what these cars are doing, because in order to navigate the real world, they have to collect and analyze a tremendous amount of information. Where the car is, what buildings are around it, what cars are around it, what human beings or animals are around it, what obstacles may be in the roadway, how fast you're going, what direction you're going, is it raining, is it sunning, is the sun shining? What happens to all this data? Is it being stored in the car? Is it being transmitted? Could it be used to, in some way, to track you, to give away your position on the planet? Should we be concerned about this?
Well, for right now, what I understand is this data is being collected for testing, and it's very important to collect this data and store the data from the technology point of view. Waymo and Uber and Ford want to make sure that they understand what all their mapping technology is collecting and how it's changing and how the cars respond to the environment around them. But, you know, you bring up an interesting point. I've been in both a Waymo, a Google car, as well as a Uber autonomous car. And what I've found is that, it's not a smooth ride necessarily. You know, these cars are, especially the Waymo car that I rode in, was responded quite abruptly to, like, leaves on the road. It detected that as some sort of object in the road, and it abruptly stopped. And that was interesting to me because it couldn't perceive the density of the object. It just saw that as sort of like an object in front of it, even though a human driving would just drive right through the leaves. I'm sorry, this is a light branch, not a leaf. And so it occurred to me, and this is what the engineers will say too, is that the testing needs to evolve to be not just on test tracks, not just on one express lane, as you mentioned, the toll road express lane. they need to be more real-world environments to test these cars in, so that they can really collect these. The engineers can really collect data on how the cars should and could respond to surprises, to weather, to the abrupt animal that runs across, and what might be just paper flying in the wind and not necessarily a heavy object that's about to fall onto the car. So not every mile. So the car makers will say, and the software makers of these autonomous cars will say, we need millions and millions of testing miles. But not every mile is created equal. You know, if you're just on a track and you're testing, or you're just on a few roads that are just a straight lane highway, you don't have, and you're just only testing changing lanes. Mm-hmm. You're not giving the car the full experience of what a human would have to encounter as a driver.
I know I have to let you go, but before I do, because you've been in these driverless cars, I just want, just a sentence, what it feels like to be in those cars, because you are not a passenger in the car with somebody else driving, and you're not the driver of the car. The car is the driver of the car. What's that like?
Well, in both of these cases, there was somebody sitting in the driver's seat. Hands were off the wheel, the brake or acceleration pad. It's because in both these cases, the laws require somebody to be there. But the car was driving by itself. It was pretty impressive, very impressive. And I saw on a laptop and a different dashboard, just how the car was navigating the mapping technology, the mapping data that had already been collected by these firms. And it's very impressive. I could see how the future does not feel so far away, but I think, like Dr. Cummings said, there is so much more that has to happen. And again, these tests were conducted in very limited conditions and on just a few roads. So, to put them in a real environment, especially since a lot of this will happen first in urban environments,
right,
to fully do that, there needs so much more to be done on the technological side as well as on the regulatory side and culturally to get humans to feel comfortable to have these cars around them.
Which we'll talk more about as we go through the hour, but I have to let you go now. Cecilia Kang is a technology and policy reporter for the New York Times who has been covering this pretty extensively in that paper. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it, Cecilia.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome. We're also here with Dr. Mary Cummings, who's director of the Humans and Autonomy Laboratory at Duke University. Let's go back a little bit here, because when you talk about human-unmanned vehicle interaction, which is something that you study, how do you see it playing out in real life? I mean, you have actually been studying how humans have been interacting with cars for about 15 years. What have you noticed?
Well, we're terrible drivers. I don't care how good you think you are. And this is your own personal conversation you need to have with yourself. Even if you think you're the best driver out there, which, of course, the majority of people think they're great drivers, that you are still human. And that means that you are still subject to fatigue. You are still subject to distraction, and the arrival of electronic devices has shown us just how brittle our attention is. And indeed, that is why we have seen the uptick of accident rates over this past year. And, now we're at 36,000 deaths annually on the road. You just would rather be doing something else. You're bored with driving, and the human brain needs stimulation, and you've decided that you'd rather do something else than fully attend to driving.
Wow. So when these cars become a reality, how will they work? I mean, will we simply walk out to the garage or the curb, get in the car, close the door, and say, take me to work? And then it will go? Is that how it will work?
Yes. I mean, thinking even further down the road, one of the projects I'm working on right now is a flying car project. So, even better, you'll just get in your car. Sometimes it'll drive and sometimes it'll fly, and you'll get where you want to go faster with less congestion. And so that is definitely the future. I am very optimistic about where we're going.
You're optimistic about flying cars? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Oh, yes. I've been working on flying cars for many years. Of course, as a former pilot, why
Why have to get out of a car to get into a plane and vice versa?
So when these...
this research is sponsored by NASA. It's not just me thinking about it, and there are about a dozen companies around the world who are actually actively developing this technology.
And when do you think that'll be on the scene?
Well, the flying part is the easy part, actually. I think that's what people don't understand. You're far more likely to get in a vehicle that can fly itself. In fact, most of you do anyway when you're flying an airline.
Yeah.
So that's the driving. That's the tricky part of this problem.
Isn't the reason that an airliner can fly itself is that it doesn't really have to contend with the kind of congestion in the air that we experience on the ground? I mean, there are laws and regulations that keep planes apart and people watching where the planes are at all times, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an obstacle density issue. Mm-hmm. You don't have, 40 other planes within inches of your car. You don't have people walking around. You don't have bicyclists. You don't have balls coming into the, airways. And so the world of driving, even though it's minus the third dimension of altitude, is far more complex than the world of flying.
So we're going to talk about, when we come back, how we become comfortable, we as passengers, owners of these cars or users of these cars, and how we become comfortable with that over time, and will we change our relationship to cars because of this? Will we actually be owners of cars anymore? It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about self-driving or driverless cars, where the technology stands today and when you will be in one. Dr. Mary or Missy Cummings is director of the Humans and Autonomy Laboratory at Duke University. She joins us from the studios of WUNC in Durham. We have an email here from Elisa who says, we already have driverless cars, people totally distracted, texting, putting on makeup. These cars don't have drivers, just a body in the seat. I would feel much safer with self-driving cars. And Fred emails, autonomous cars might not make better decisions, but they will make the decisions that distracted and incompetent drivers fail to make. However, you'll have to pry the wheel from my cold, dead hands. That leads us to this. Do people really want these? There are a lot of people that like to drive. That's why they buy the car that they buy, because it's fun to drive. But if you're not going to drive the car, if some of these new cars will have no steering wheels, you will not be able to drive the car, then the car becomes a conveyance, a convenient conveyance, and not what it is today, this sexy statement about who you are. What's that going to do to the automobile industry?
Well, I think there's a lot to think about here. First of all, it's not going to happen overnight. There will be rollout of vehicles. For example, the ride-sharing services, Uber, Lyft, that will happen first. And so it's not going to replace your car. It might replace some sort of public transportation system. And so you will still have your car, but then we will kind of ease you into this world where occasionally you'll be in a ride-sharing service or, some kind of bus system. And so you will see public transportation adopt these technologies first, and then it will be a slow transition. We already see kids today are postponing getting their licenses later and later. And young people today are foregoing car ownership. It doesn't make sense, particularly if you live in urban environments. And so that will increase. And then eventually, will you totally get rid of your car? I can see, if we look into the future where flying cars, like we talked about before, are out there, I predict that there will be national parks just for driving. So you will take your car and go somewhere special and fun, and it'll be a recreational activity where you get to really have that experience, because many people do love driving. I think where we will see the replacement is in the urban commute, both locally, but what will happen is this will transform regional development and also how people live and go to work.
I mean, a lot of money and resources are dedicated to making every car different in some way and attractive to different segments of the market. Whether you want a powerful muscle car or you want a luxury sedan or you need an SUV, it's the kind of thing that you're making these personal decisions. But won't we eventually come with these driverless cars? won't we come to a time when it doesn't make any sense to buy a car, that the car manufacturers will simply make these cars for services, and these cars will be hailable on your smartphone like an Uber, and you'll just get in and say, go, take me here. And that's what it will do. They'll just be everywhere. So it will be a personalized form of public transportation.
Agreed. And there will still be a high-end market. People who own cars will be, you know, in some sort of upper middle class arena where, you know, you have the money and the resources, then you will own your own car to occasionally take to the driving national park.
But if there's no steering wheel in the car, what's the point?
Oh, some will. I mean, those will. Like we think of classic cars, you know, we think of the old 19, you know, whatever, Ford Galaxy. That's how we will think of cars with steering wheels.
Because Tesla, as you point out, already has this self-driving mechanism, which I think that they have turned off because of an accident that has occurred and somebody lost their life as a result of it. But it's still built into the software, and at some point they will either turn it back on, or maybe you can turn it on yourself if you want to now.
It's on. Okay. I mean, they've just updated it.
I have driven a Tesla, and the thing that's attractive about the Tesla to me is the fact it is a beast. I mean, it drives. Who would want to give it over to let it drive itself? That's the fun of it.
Agreed, but people are going to, on commutes, people in urban environments, I don't think that there's any question, and the car companies would not be investing as much money. In fact, I think one of the statistics that catches a lot of people by surprise is that the automotive industry is outspending the defense industry 3-1 to do research and development for autonomous cars. This is serious business, and it's serious business because the business model exists.
Now, these are run by computers ingesting scads of information and analyzing it and making decisions in split-second timing. And since this computer that landed the Apollo mission on the moon is far less powerful than a smartphone, we know that computers have all this power available to them to make these decisions quickly. But anybody who uses a computer or a smartphone knows that these things fail you from time to time. They slow down. They can't open a program fast enough for you, even though yesterday it was opening in a split second. Today you're sitting there waiting for the wheel to stop spinning. We've all experienced crashes while we're typing something in Word where you lose all of your document. Computers in cars cannot slow down. They cannot fail you. They cannot be subject to glitches. Will we ever have a glitch-free computer in a car that runs the car perfectly?
Well, they're all electric aircraft right now, and one could argue that this was actually the same discussion, debate people had 30 years ago in the 1970s when we started to go to fly-by-wire aircraft with no conventional controls. And the reality is we are there now because we have developed that robust of a set of technologies that have redundant technologies to guard against failure. I flew an F-18. The controls would freeze just like you have described, but there's a button that you hit that would instantly, in a second, reset the entire system and you are off and running. So, you know, we know how to do it. The question is how to make it cost effective to do it.
You've said that though you're enthusiastic about research into these vehicles, you are decidedly less optimistic about what you perceive to be a rush to field systems that are absolutely not necessary. Is that a danger that these things will come out and be on the roads in significant numbers when they're really not ready to be there?
I think so. I think that Silicon Valley, in concert with some but not all car manufacturers, there is a big race to field the first driverless car, and I put that in air quotes because it's not even really clear how to define when you go from driver to driverless car. But I do think that what this sets up is an environment where you can take shortcuts. And right now, I think NHTSA is doing the absolute worst move that they could make, is to try to force each individual state to try to regulate these technologies, because this is very complicated technology. Even the Department of Defense has no idea really how to certify an autonomous vehicle. And if the people who have the most advanced technology in the United States can't figure it out, I hardly think the states at an individual level are going to figure this out.
Why would they even think that's a good idea? These cars are going to be manufactured by big-time manufacturers. This is not going to be the Wright brothers sitting in a garage someplace cranking out a car or two a week. This is going to be General Motors and Fiat, Chrysler and Ford and Tesla and others. So why wouldn't you regulate this at a national level? Leave the states out of it.
Because you don't want to. It's a big pain. You know, it's a headache. And I've been very critical of NHTSA about this. They don't have the people on the staff to do it. And, you know, and in their defense, they couldn't even get the people if they wanted to, because the car companies are sucking up all the experts, expert programmers, people who understand these technologies, and even the defense industry can't get their hands on these people.
And so up in your neck of the woods, Raleigh's Triangle Expressway is going to be a testing ground for these cars in the short future. Like, what, this year, next year? How will that work if these cars are not ready? Will they be on the road with regular cars? Will they shut the speed, the expressway down? Will they only do it late at night when the traffic is minimal? How will it work?
Well, they'll just have test drivers inside the car with them. And that's what's happening right now. All the companies that are putting driverless car technologies have a couple of engineers inside the system who are ready to take over at any given time. And in fact, you know, you're very safe in a system with that, because you have two people whose sole job it is to pay attention, and they really do a good job.
Well, are we more safe? Because the AP reports that experience with automation in other modes of transportation like aviation and rail suggests that self-driving cars may actually lead to more deaths, not fewer, because in situations where these cars have steering wheels and foot pedals with the expectation that humans will step in when things get dicey, humans don't, because they're watching a movie on their phone or texting somebody. They're not paying attention. The car's driving itself.
Well, we need to make the distinction between the testing of these cars and the deployment of these cars. So in the testing of these cars, we have professional engineers and safety drivers. That's their job. So while they're in the testing modes with testing experts in the car, it's very safe. Mm. If we deploy these technologies to your average human and they're not ready to be deployed, then we could see another uptick in accidents.
But even with these cars that already have these automatic braking systems, where the car will stop if it detects an obstacle, or it will keep you in your lane because you're not paying attention and you're veering out of your lane, so the car automatically moves you back. Is this going to make us better drivers, or is it making us careless drivers because we know the car will step in?
It makes us complacent. So that is my big fear, is that we know that as soon as automation gets good enough, for whatever your perspective is, but it's substantially less than perfect, that people tend to, it's called legitimate authority, people tend to give up control to what they perceive to be the legitimate authority, and in this case, it's the computer. And we've already seen that in the Joshua Brown case in Florida when he drove his Tesla into the side of a big rig when he should have been paying attention. And we're going to see this countless more as automation, as we start to get increased partial functionality. And so I believe that we are at the most dangerous place that we could be in car development. And the development of these cars is quasi-automation instead of full automation.
You're also worried about something we haven't talked about yet, and we've seen this in the movies where the fear of technology is a feature of the film. But you say it would be relatively easy for hackers to take control of a self-driving car and a self-driving car's GPS and make it do things that you don't want it to do. And in fact, just yesterday, with the WikiLeaks information that came out, the CIA evidently was either has the capability or was looking into having the capability of causing accidents against enemies. I mean, just taking their car over and driving them into a tree. Is that a legitimate fear?
GPS is a very vulnerable signal. So any technology, whether we're talking about a plane or a car, it is relatively easy to spoof GPS signals. So, yes, it is critical that we get the vulnerabilities of GPS under control. because of the ease of which, you know, someone can you not necessarily take it over, but at least trick the car to go off course. So, yes, that is a big problem, but it's not just a problem in driverless cars. It's also a problem in drones.
Is it very quickly, because I'm out of time, but is it possible to program these cars to understand that it would be okay, for instance, to cross a yellow line to avoid an accident if nothing is coming your way, because the car thinks, I can't cross the yellow line? Can you make it make decisions like that?
You can, and that's what people are working on, but it's still very much a research question right now.
Wow. I wish we had more time, maybe we'll do an update on this as things go forward, but thank you for joining us today. Dr. Mary Cummings, Director of the Humans and Autonomy Laboratory at Duke University. Thanks very much for the hour.
Thank you.